Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we are speaking with Carolyn Baker, a prominent advocate for culturing emotional resiliency in an era of transition. You know I care about that a lot. She delivers powerful observations on the social and the spiritual side of preparedness via her popular blog, CarolynBaker.net, and she has authored several books, including the recent Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse, a book I've read and can highly recommend. Carolyn was an adjunct professor of history and psychology for 11 years and a psychotherapist in private practice for nearly two decades. I am a strong believer that true resiliency includes a strong, healthy mental and emotional outlook, and I'm excited to delve into this very important topic at this time with Carolyn today. Welcome, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to finally speak with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. Perhaps you can start then. Can you provide for our audience then a sense of the type of future that you see ahead?
Yeah, I'll try to do that. The type of future that I see ahead is one in which there will be unprecedented loss at the same time that there will be unprecedented opportunity. And in terms of loss, the lifestyles to which most of us have become accustomed will be drastically downsized due to the converging crisis of energy, economics, and the environment.
Now, I've heard that somewhere before.
I know you have. And I've watched the Crash Course several times. So this is already happening dramatically and far more rapidly than anyone could have anticipated. Peak oil, the end of money as we know it, the escalating climate change, all of these will temper everything we do. And this is the new normal, and there's no going back to the old normal. These drastic and daunting changes will invariably and unequivocally evoke enormous emotional responses in people, as they already are. In terms of fear, panic, anger, depression, despair, and in many cases, off the charts, addictions and suicides. Now, we don't have to look very far in communities where economic collapse has hit the hardest to see an escalation of all of these symptoms. I've just returned from Vermont, which was very hard hit, not the whole state, but many parts of the state very hard hit by Hurricane Irene. And I can tell you that these issues are coming up faster than anyone can imagine. Now, of course, these are representative of one way that humans can respond, but these are not the only ways. If we're awake and conscious now regarding the collapse of industrial civilization, we'll be preparing ourselves emotionally as well as logistically for these changes. And I've written two books in the past 3 years that detail specific ways in which we can build emotional resilience to prepare us for the future. Much of this has to do with developing a rich inner life, which then allows us to build solid community with others. And if we don't do the inner work, it will be very difficult to establish meaningful and workable relationships with others. Now, in my latest book, which you did not mention, but I want to make sure people know about it, Navigating the Coming Chaos, a handbook for inner transition, I've included actually in both books specific exercises for doing this work that will assist the reader in developing a rich inner life and thereby facilitating the development of mutually supportive relationships.
Now, what do you mean by inner life? What is a rich inner life?
A rich inner life is where we take some of the attention away from the external and we begin to connect with some of the resources that are within ourselves. And, you know, a lot of times we don't even know that we have those resources consciously. We don't think about them, you know, because we're so busy looking at the external picture and our focus is directed so much outward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what we need in order to develop emotional resiliency.
Right. You know, I have a good friend who runs a wilderness school that my kids are involved with. And nominally, it's all about learning the tools and tricks and the trades of living out in the woods in a primitive way. It has much, much deeper layers under that, which are the actual goals of the program. But at any rate, this gentleman was approached by an author who said, listen, I'm writing a book on what would the ultimate survival bag look like. You know, if you could only have like 100 cubic inches, what would you put in that bag? And he said, sure, I'll talk to you. So this author comes out and he says, all right, what goes in this bag? I'm going to give you like 5 of the cubic inches. What do you put in there? And he says, nothing. I'm not going to put anything in. And there are all these 6, 7, 8-year-olds running around he's being interviewed. And the author said, what do you mean nothing? He said, well, it turns out that the most important survival tool you have is what you know. It's your brain. It's your outlook. It's your your frame of mind. That's the most important thing. The author said, what do you mean? He said, okay, watch this. And he yells out to the kids, kids, I've just fallen through the ice. I have 5 minutes before I'm going to freeze to death. What do you do? And bang, these 6, 7, 8-year-olds, they immediately, one says, I'm going to get the tinder. Another says, I'm going to get the kindling. And a third one, you know, another set says, we're going to go off and get the larger wood. And somebody else whips out a bow drill. And within 5 minutes from wood only to a fire, they had it going. And he said, this is what I'm talking about. And the author was stunned. He's like, what is happening here? He said, well, these kids have learned that they don't rely on or depend on anything really other than what they have or can obtain for themselves. And
Absolutely.
That's true resiliency. And so if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that there are these troubled times coming, and it's one thing to get our physical infrastructure set up, and that's wonderful, and we should do that. Maybe we're growing food, we have a garden, maybe we've learned how to be more energy resilient. But when times get tough, knowing that we've got the equivalent of a deep larder inside is a really important survival tool, as well as maybe a growth tool. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, yes.
So what are the key tenets then of emotional resiliency? How do we go about fostering that?
Well, emotional resilience means many things, but among them I would consider foremost establishing a relationship with the sacred or something greater that allows us to find meaning in our experiences. The word sacred is not a religious word at all, but as I use it, it just simply means something greater than the rational mind and the human ego. We find this not in people or institutions outside ourselves, but deeply within ourselves, generally through the emotions and through our appreciation of beauty and creativity. When people have a connection with something greater, they're more likely to find meaning and purpose in their lives in general and in what are likely to be the daunting realities of collapse specifically. In my book, Sacred Demise, I noted the work of Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor and wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, he states that in the Nazi death camps, of which he was a survivor, it was the people who were able to find just a little bit of meaning in their daily experiences who were able to endure the horrors of their situation and stay centered amid what was going on around them. And so we begin to develop emotional resilience by becoming familiar with our emotions and our intuition, particularly what have come to be known as the so-called dark emotions, like grief and anger, fear and despair. And in my books, I provide specific exercises that people can use to work with these emotions, to utilize them in becoming more resilient, more empowered, more alert to what is going on inside of them and within their environment. And without this kind of preparation, even the most reskilled person who's made excellent logistical preparation will very likely be overwhelmed in a world of terrified, angry, depressed human beings. A person can have the most awesomely equipped doomstead on earth and yet completely lose their grip emotionally in just a few minutes without emotional and spiritual resilience.
You know, I've had some experience with this in my life where I've noted that depending on which story I have running in my head, my experience can either be completely miserable or completely joyful. It's really that profound. It's the idea of having the right narrative in play. So you're suggesting that if individuals can start to work with those narratives, potentially also gain mastery over their own reactions and understand the pathways inside of themselves that lead to one set of emotions arising rather than another, that these are all components of resilience?
Absolutely. And by doing this, I believe that people are going to have more options emotionally. You know, if one response doesn't work well, you might have a whole toolkit that you can draw on.
Right. So as I look into this, I know that, to paraphrase a bit, you've said that infinite growth is possible, actually, as long as we're talking about internal growth. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by internal growth is, again, looking at these emotions, working with them, not being afraid to really go through them. Because, you know, in the word emotion, we have the word motion. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, I don't want to deal with grief because I'll get stuck in it, or mm-hmm. maybe any other emotion. But, you know, if we allow ourselves to go into that emotion, and I want to emphasize we need to do this with support of some kind, we find that those emotions just naturally flow and change, and we don't get stuck on them, in them. We actually move through, and generally we find ourselves bigger people, having much more of a repertoire emotionally than we knew we had.
Now, I'm really intrigued by you say it's good to do this with support of some kind. A general question or response that we get a lot at our site is that people are often in mismatched partnerships, meaning that one of them sees these changes unfolding, wants to respond to them. The other partner does not either see them or wants to remain in denial around them. And this creates some tension. How does, if you were in that sort of a relationship, how would you find the support you needed?
Well, you know, over the past 2 years, I've been doing a great deal of life coaching around collapse, and many of my clients have been dealing with a sense of aloneness in their world, mm-hmm. perhaps with partners or family members who are not on board with the reality of collapse, or maybe they're just finding themselves in a milieu where there's no one to talk about preparation with. So one of the first things I suggest to such individuals, whether or not they're in a partnership with someone else, is that they get themselves connected with a transition group or some other group of folks who understand collapse and are preparing for it. I believe that we absolutely cannot prepare in isolation. So connection with others is the first action step in dealing with estrangement. And I also suggest, and I give these out in workshops a lot, suggest people read the article that your wife Becca wrote on dealing with a reluctant partner, which I believe is still at your website.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I coach people in specific ways to communicate with partners and family members and friends about collapse, because often the way they're doing it is not working. Mm. And all of this has kind of motivated me to create a one-day workshop on relationships in the long emergency, which I'm delighted to take to any community where we can get 10 or more people together to work on these issues. And I ask people to consider bringing their partner or family members to the workshop with them so that they can work all together, because I want to honor the concerns of the people in their lives who are resisting talking about and preparing for collapse.
Absolutely.
I
can't resist. How would people contact you in order to bring that workshop to their community?
They only have to email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net.
Okay.
And so, in fact, in all the workshops I do, I structure specific ways in which people can build community with each other in the workshop and take these tools home to utilize them there to feel less isolated and more connected.
Okay. I mean, that sounds like a very important workshop. When my wife and I do workshops, it is a piece that comes up a lot, is how do we manage the emotional aspects of this, dealing with friends, colleagues, coworkers, reluctant partners, people who, that it's that sense of aloneness in the face of something that seems so large. Why would we want all the support we can possibly get? It's very challenging times. And as I look across the landscape today, it couldn't be more obvious. Everything, all the warning signs that people such as yourself, myself, many others have been talking about are there, suggesting that there is going to be no return to the old normal. There's some sort of new normal coming. And reading Dmitry Orlov's work around his study and observations of what happened when the former USSR collapsed, the number one predator in that land was alcoholism and suicide. I guess those two predators, but they're often related and become one. So what you're talking about is we really want to avoid going down that path, because those are actually avoidable outcomes, aren't they?
Yes, they are, absolutely. And, you know, wherever financial collapse has hit the hardest right now, we can see an you know, a spike in all of those things. And so we really need to be prepared for that. As a matter of fact, when I was in Vermont, I met with two different groups of helping professionals that were, you know, so ready to really go deeper in this whole topic, and because they work with folks who are being directly affected, and, you know, and they're being squeezed by the whole collapse of healthcare and so on. So these are just incredibly important and timely issues.
So if there's really no chance then of returning to normal, if we define that as like steadily increasing living standards for as far as the eye can see, the writing's clearly on the wall, yet really very few people seem able to face or assimilate the dots into a coherent picture that leads to either or both internal or external change. Why is that, and how do we help, or is there anything we can do?
Well, I think it's because, particularly in the United States, we're a very young and adolescent nation. We don't have a long history. We don't, I think, have the historical maturity that a lot of nations have. And so it's very difficult for us in this culture that is, of course, so inundated with consumerism and media, very difficult for us to really take a hard look at issues, because everything in this culture invites us to distract. So that is the number one thing. And, you know, I'm constantly running into people who are saying, I want to talk about anything else but this. And it's often very hard for people who have children to really go to these places. So, you know, my encouragement is, my hope, my optimism is that a lot of people are waking up. I encounter this more and more.
I'm certainly seeing that as well. Right now, I'm noticing in certain circles, it's still sort of a surreptitious awakening where behind closed doors, we'll have one set of conversations and in public, maybe another. But certainly people who are closer to the pulse of things, oddly, so the people who have the most to lose, people who are really deeply embedded in the status quo, by which I mean very wealthy, well-connected people, certainly seem to get it. There's almost a class divide here in some ways for me. I think that I'm noticing that there are some classes of people seem to be getting this story more a little bit more quickly, and it's not just socioeconomic, but there are groups that seem more predisposed to the idea that change could happen, and they want to be in front of it, and other groups that seem less disposed towards that. Do you notice this, and do you have you noticed it? And Jim Kunstler talks about it in terms of, he breaks it grossly into regions, thinking some regions are going to be better than others, but a lot of people very cautiously and carefully are trying to select the communities and areas that they are going to live in part because they're hoping some areas are more resilient. Have you noticed that there's really a distinct difference between certain locales or locations compared to others?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, for every rule, there's an exception.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've noticed that in places like just having been in Vermont, there's a tremendous consciousness there that, you know, I was noticing that there's more receptivity there 2 years later from the last time I was there, so that many of the things I said 2 years ago, I would have been laughed out of the room or people would have gotten up and walked out. But especially with the recent disaster there, people were very, very open and receptive. But, you know, you can go down the road to, you know, five houses away and somebody doesn't want to hear about it. So, you know, it's interesting because we were kind of talking when I was in Vermont about, you know, Kunstler talks about, oh, don't go to the west, there's no water there. And so here in Colorado, we have our water issues, but people were sort of laughing about the fact that when I left there and went to Colorado, left Vermont, people were sort of warning me, oh, you know, not enough water. And so I've been joking with them about, well, you want to talk about water, you guys have had too much recently. So we just, you know, with all the natural disasters, with climate change and so forth, it's kind of a crapshoot. We really don't have any hard and fast rules at all. And again, it's that inner wisdom that I ask people to follow in terms of what calls them and what feels like the place where you need to be.
Well, that's interesting that you phrase it that way. I've been noticing, I was just on the phone giving a bit of a sermon to an MBA class recently, and at the end I was asked, you know, well, what businesses do we go into for a post-peak world? And instead of giving the usual, well, you know, here's your more resilient businesses piece, I talked to them instead about what's been true for me lately, which is that the most important job you can possibly have going forward is one that you personally have an attachment to its purpose. You get it on some deep visceral level that this is a job worth doing. And if the money's there, great, but money shouldn't be our guiding beacon anymore. When I was in MBA school, graduated in 98, that was, you know, it was all about the money, right? But now my advice is for people to really follow that inner guide and say, what is it that I really want to do? Because I think it's time to follow our hearts in this regard and follow our intuition. What do you think?
Absolutely. I have a whole chapter in Navigating the Coming Chaos about meaning and purpose. And, you know, there are two questions that I keep inviting people to ask themselves. One is, who do I want to be in the face of this collapse? And secondly, what did I come here to do? And, you know, I just suggest that folks keep asking that second question when they're in a dilemma about what is my life work? How best can I serve myself? And I deal with this a lot with people who call me, you know, and say, I had this job for 30 years. It's gone. It'll never come back. I have to reinvent myself. What do I do? And that's one of the first steps that I lead them toward is, what is my meaning and purpose? How do I find that?
Well, a while ago you said that of course there's going to be there's loss involved in this story, but there's also extraordinary opportunities. So one of the opportunities you're surfacing now is the opportunity to reinvent ourselves in the face of this larger reinvention that's happening. How does somebody really go about discovering what it is that they're here to do?
Well, one of the ways that they can do that is, I think, with working with other people. Again, I want to emphasize getting involved with transition groups. There's also a newer group, which some people might be aware of, called Resilience Circles at localcircles.org. Mm-hmm. It's another resource for creating neighborhood and community awareness and food security. You know, as you mentioned Dmitry a while ago, and how important it was for people in the Soviet Union to stay together, to protect each other, watch each other's backs. Not go out too late and never by themselves. And, you know, to start to build this kind of connection now. And I think that through that process, oftentimes that becomes a catalyst for people to go, oh, yeah, there is this something inside that's calling me. And, you know, you talked about prosperity, and I just want to clarify that we need to redefine prosperity mm-hmm. to mean something very different from what we've known it to be in this culture. None of us is going to be prosperous as mainstream culture defines it, but we may very well be able to have what we need and really enjoy life, perhaps even more than we do now.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And we're going to have to not just redefine prosperity, but redefine, I believe, how it is we interact with the larger world, by which I mean not just the human-based one, but there's clear signs that are abundantly obvious, whether it's falling water tables or disappearing soil or species loss, or really it's the larger biodiversity piece or soil destruction, turning it into dirt, if not losing it outright. All of these pieces are actually just screaming, I think, pretty loudly at this point in time. And so what we're talking about then is really redefining not just our relationship to money, but our relationships to each other and to the larger world around us, that this is an enormous period of maturation, if we're going to use your analogy of saying that, you know, our country culturally is in an adolescent stage. We want to become young adults in this story, so we have to figure out what works. Keep doing that, what hasn't been working, so we want to stop doing that, and then we want to figure out what new things we might need to start entertaining as ideas. What are those in your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to offer some other options here. In addition to the plethora of resources that I offer in my books, I want to emphasize training and healing trauma. Hmm. I've become very interested in this lately because, number one, I believe all of us on some level who've grown up in industrial civilization have been to some extent traumatized. And I believe there's going to be a lot of trauma increasing around us as these changes begin to unfold. And so one of the things that I'm working with right now and getting some training in myself is a modality called somatic experiencing. People can find out about that at traumahealing.com. This is a modality that anyone can use themselves, and you can use it with other people. It was developed by a psychologist named Peter Levine that he developed as a result of a terrible accident that he had himself. And I say this because I believe that much of our future may be traumatic on a number of levels. And somatic experiencing teaches people how to stabilize the nervous system and utilize resources that are innate in our own physiology to help us move through traumatic experiences. I also encourage people to develop some kind of stillness practice that takes their attention into the inner world at least once a day. This is one of the most important pillars in building what I call an internal bunker. You know, we hear the survivalist talking about building his bunker with his wife and kids and weapons and food and all of that, but we need to build internal bunkers. And I also encourage people, and this, of course, is along the lines of what you just said about the relationship with the Earth community, I really encourage people to connect with nature on a regular basis and not to do that casually, but with great intention. Spend time in nature in silence and perhaps take a journal with you and write or draw your awarenesses and allow yourself to be nurtured by nature, to commune with it, and above all, to listen to it. And then another piece that I've been talking about a lot lately is how important it is to create beauty and joy in your life. Preparation can and should be fun, at least sometimes. And so the use of poetry, dance, music, story, and art to nurture your soul and balance the darkness with joy is very, very important.
I couldn't agree more. I really, truly believe that it's the how we conduct ourselves during the journey is really important. You know, you asked two questions that you like to leave people with to think about is, you know, who do I want to be and what is it I want to do? It's around that first part, though, you know, who do I want to be and how do I want to be in all of this? I think it's really important that we have gratitude because we still have just tremendous abundance, historically speaking.
Yes,
we have immense resources in front of us, as scary as it all looks, because, yes, there's some loss. We are losing some things. Our monetary system is no longer functioning properly. In my judgment, our leaders have absolutely no clue about what the real nature of the predicament actually is, and they're going to preserve status quo at all costs. And unfortunately, some of those costs are risks, such as potential destruction of our currency, et cetera, and so forth. Big, scary stuff.
Yep.
At the same time, the sun rises every day. We still have, you know, our faculties and wits and most cases our health with us, and so everything is still possible in that world. And so here we are, and it's today, whichever day people are listening to this. What would you recommend for somebody who's hearing this and is itching and is saying, I really, you know what, I'm ready to dive off into that? You've mentioned transition towns. You've mentioned some other resources. What's that first step for somebody who's just coming into this and says, I think I need to learn more about this? What would they do?
Well, you know, this is going to sound really kind of hokey, but we're speaking of gratitude, and so I'd like to invite that person, even if it's a cloudy day, to go outside and just kind of look at the sun and close their eyes and say, thank you, sun, that you're there and that you're still warming the earth and that we have all these resources because of you. And notice what they feel in their bodies as they do that. And then they might want to, you know, begin reading one or both of my books. Certainly we have great lists of books and documentaries on just learning about peak oil and the collapse of industrial civilization in general. But I want to invite people to consider reading my books. And also, I'm traveling around the country now as much as possible doing workshops on navigating the coming chaos, living in turbulent times. My next one is going to be on October 15th in Chico, California, with my friends Susie Gruber and Jerry Allen. And you can find details of that event on my website. I'll also be doing one in Nevada City on November 19th. And then, you know, I'm just really open. And if people want me to come to your community, you want to organize one of those workshops, they're fantastic. So just contact me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net.
Well, that's fantastic. I hope people do take you up on that. I really believe that we have some immense challenges in front of us, and that how we respond to them is of critical importance. And many of our old tools, old ways of responding are probably ill-suited for this new reality that's coming. We're going to have to really be bold. And the interesting part to me is that as I look back on all of this, I see that many of the skills and practices are not new ones, are they? They're actually quite old, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, as people ask me, you know, are the behaviors you advocate new approaches, or are they the return of forgotten wisdom, I say yes. And by that I mean that both are true. We desperately need to return to ancient perennial wisdom, and we need to apply it in ways that fit for our time. First, we need to understand, and this I talk about in great depth in Sacred Demise, we need to understand the ancient indigenous principle of initiation, in which the young person was taken out into nature and given specific ordeals to endure in order to become a mature adult and become integrated into tribal culture. And today we need to understand that the collapse of industrial civilization is a cultural and planetary initiation in which every woman and man is being tested by circumstances in order to bring us to maturity and bring us again into intimate connection with the human community and the Earth community. And like indigenous people who've been colonized by a dominant culture, we need to uncolonize ourselves emotionally and spiritually. Mm. In indigenous cultures, stories were passed down from generation to generation, which guided the community in its worldview and in its behavior. And then as those traditional cultures become colonized, those stories were lost as tradition was subsumed by modernity. So new stories of infinite growth and progress supplanted the old ones. And today we're witnessing the end product of the stories of industrial civilization. The old story has produced societies that are failing miserably, and as we work to build the next culture, we need to not return to the stories of civilization, but the ancient stories, and using those, we need to create brand new stories that will guide us and prevent us from allowing anything like industrial civilization to ever occur again on this planet. And I just want to say one more thing about that. I believe that we're all standing on an evolutionary threshold in which we have the possibility not only of creating a new culture, but actually becoming a new kind of human being that will understand how to live in connection with ourselves and each other and with the Earth. So much of the suffering and angst that will happen in the meantime, we have to be prepared for, but if we can work with it instead of resist it, that evolutionary leap may be possible.
Mm. Great words, and we certainly are all hoping that we can navigate these coming times well, elegantly, and certainly growing through it all, because there is a possibility, there is, the framework I hold says that, yes, there's the chance of disruptions, yes, there is the possibility of some unpleasant times, and there's also the possibility of real growth, real learning, real purpose coming back into our lives in important ways. And so this is, I don't know if there's anything more unnerving for a culture than when its dominant narrative begins to break down. And there's enough in our story right now that we know at the national level is just not working. I mean, whatever level you unpack it at. So we could just say, what's our energy policy in the United States? And let's compare that against what we know to be the energy realities. And you can't line those two stories up. There's just an enormous gap between them. And anybody who experiences that gap and sees it for what it is, of course you feel anxiety. Like one of these two things is desperately wrong here. And I think I know which one it is. And so what we need to do is in the absence of a collective national narrative that makes any sense, I guess, well, it's up to us in our communities and ourselves to figure out what's true, how we want to align ourselves with that, knowing that nobody knows how the future is going to turn out. But boy, we can make some prudent decisions to mitigate risks, strengthen ourselves, be resilient. And the worst that could happen with that, the worst that could happen is you end up, in my experience, is you end up saving money. You end up being in tighter community. You end up finding more out about yourself. You find yourself in deeper, richer relationships. These are all things that everybody is seeking anyway. So you get all that. And if it turns out these disruptions do happen, you're in a better position than you would have been otherwise. I don't see the downside.
I don't either. And, you know, as you speak about community and small areas, I just want to underscore that with natural disasters proliferating and being what they are, it is entirely possible that, you know, many communities will be absolutely cut off from other communities. Again, I think of my experience in Vermont and the many communities that were cut off for even 4 or 5 days, which isn't a long time in the long term of things, but these folks were cut off for 4 or 5 days from everything else in every direction. And what they reported is, we came together, we cooked meals for each other, we had times of celebration, we asked each other how we could help, you know, we cleaned up for each other, and it was really quite amazing. So I really want to emphasize that the very small scale, even the neighborhood level, is extremely important to be working on.
Absolutely. And on those encouraging words of hope, I'm going to close this and just mention again, we're talking with Carolyn Baker, and it's just been my pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we get to do this again sometime.
I do too, and I'm so happy that you asked me to do this.
Well, I'm glad you accepted, and we'll be seeing each other, I'm sure, at some point. I'll be out in California roughly the same time you're going to be with in your October conference out there, so perhaps our paths will cross. I certainly hope so.
Me too.
Be well.
Thank you, Chris.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.